is a deliberate act of violence against innocent children and other people worshiping.
We begin this hour in Minneapolis after a mass shooting at a Roman Catholic school.
Today is Wednesday, August 27th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The FDA is restricting the new COVID vaccines to older adults or people at high risk.
I'm worried that this administration's recommendations put the entire population at risk.
Also, the important research that helped Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook make her name in economics.
If there is something that impedes the rate of arrival of ideas, you're going to slow down the economy.
And we go to a store in Kansas City that's very excited about the engagement between Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Gunfire erupted this morning at a Catholic church in Minneapolis, killing two children and injuring 17 others, including children. Authorities have identified the shooter as 23-year-old Robin Westman. NPR's Juliana Kim reports.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz says students were in the middle of their first week of classes when the unthinkable happened.
Filled with the first days of school, of beautiful children going to learn those values, share with their teachers and their classmates. And instead of that joy and that curiosity and that learning, they were met with evil and horror and death.
Local authorities said 14 children between the ages of 6 and 15 were injured by gunfire. Three adult parishioners who were in their 80s were also wounded. Investigators also said the shooter appeared to have no prior criminal history, but they were currently reviewing an apparent manifesto written by Westman. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
At least a dozen employees of the Federal Emergency Management Agency have been suspended. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports the workers signed their names to a public letter warning that the Trump administration is undercutting the agency's ability to respond to disasters.
The letter was sent to Congress on Monday and was signed by nearly 200 current and former employees. Most of the signatories were anonymous. Among the concerns detailed in that letter, they note that FEMA's leader has no experience managing disaster response. This as peak hurricane season gets underway. Now, at least a dozen FEMA workers who signed the letter have been suspended. That's according to the advocacy group Stand Up for Science, which helped publicize the letter and spoke directly to those employees. FEMA did not respond to questions from NPR about the suspended employees. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
The Food and Drug Administration has approved the next round of COVID vaccines, but it's imposing new restrictions on who can get the shots. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
The FDA approved COVID vaccines from Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna, and Novavax. In the past, the shots have been available to anyone aged 6 months and older, but the FDA is now limiting the vaccines to people who are at risk for serious complications from COVID. That includes people ages 65 and older and younger people who have other health issues that put them at risk. Federal officials say the changes reflect how much immunity people have. Many public health experts worry the restrictions will make it too hard for other people to get vaccinated. Rob Stein, NPR News.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 147 points. The NASDAQ rose 45 points, and the S&P 500 ended the day up 15 points. This is NPR News in Washington. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said today his department will take over managing Washington's Union Station from Amtrak. He says the federal government can do a better job, attract more tenants, and generate more money. Rights groups have long criticized the European Union for funding the Coast Guard in Libya and security forces in Tunisia, despite their record of abusing the rights of migrants. Now, a new report by Human Rights Watch focuses on a lesser-known effort by the EU to prevent migrants arriving on European shores. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports.
The 142-page Human Rights Watch report highlights a deal the EU made last year with Mauritania, giving the African nation €210 million to stop migrants passing through the country as they try to reach Europe. The report documents cases in which it says Mauritanian police, Coast Guard and other security bodies have tortured, raped, extorted and detained migrants in inhumane conditions. Human Rights Watch says the European Union and Spain, which funded the effort separately, share responsibility for the abuses. The European Commission says its partnership with Mauritania is, quote, solidly anchored in respect for rights. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
Thousands of people descended on a town in eastern Spain today for an annual food fight. This is the 80th anniversary of Tomatina, when participants throw tons of overripe tomatoes at each other. It's not clear exactly how the tradition started, but has grown to attract people from all around the world. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. This is NPR.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. Coming up in a few moments, a conversation with Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar about today's shooting in Minneapolis. Programming is supported by Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, providing the energy to help power ideas and strengthen rural development throughout northern Minnesota. More at lakecountrypower.coop. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. We have a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. We're going to start this hour in Minneapolis, where this morning a shooter opened fire on a Catholic mass that was meant to mark the first week of school. Law enforcement says the shooter fired through the windows of the Annunciation Roman Catholic Church, killing two children, ages 8 and 10, and injuring 17 people. Police say the shooter then died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Here's Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara during a press conference earlier today.
This was a deliberate act of violence against innocent children and other people worshiping. The sheer cruelty and cowardice of firing into a church full of children is absolutely incomprehensible.
Joining us now to talk about what has happened in her state is Senator Amy Klobuchar. Welcome, Senator, and I'm so sorry that
Thank you, Elsa, speaking
under these circumstances. I know that you are in Minneapolis right now. How have you been spending the last several hours?
Well, I have been over at the church and the school with the mayor and the police officials, and it is one thing people have to understand, your listeners, is that this was about this incredibly close community, a faith community. Yes, the church is next to a school, so it was very little kids, you know, kindergarten through eighth grade. Some of the youngest kids all in the mass together because it's their first weeks of school. Obviously, like any other parent, you can imagine this, the kids excited about their new teachers, what's happening. Yeah. And then this madman shoots through the windows. The children are hiding under pews. I know this first thing because one of my former employees and a close friend, Kate Nyland, she has three children that were in that church. And one of them, her daughter, Cora, actually saw two of her good friends being shot, one in the stomach, one in the neck.
Oh my God.
She ran out. When they finally got out of the church, she actually told the father of one of the kids what had happened. So this community and these kids that were in there, they're going to be scarred by this forever. But then embracing this church and embracing this archbishop was there, the priests were there today, later in the afternoon, is this incredible neighborhood. Like, literally, there's a house next to the church, and then next to the houses is a shop, and next to the shop is another school. So this has always been a close-knit city neighborhood, and they're very proud of their neighborhood. So in that way, I feel this love for this community. But what happened to these families was just absolutely horrific.
Have you had the chance to talk to any other family members of victims, in addition to close friend whose daughter saw such horrific things?
I've talked to her. I've gotten texts from other relatives of other people that were in there, including one that is on the operating table or was on the operating table. Actually, the most incredible news we had from Police Chief O'Hara this afternoon is that they believe all the other children will survive, and that tribute to the heroic actions. There were 14 kids that were injured. There were 3 adults that were injured. And there is going to be stories told of the church personnel that were in there, of the teachers, of other kids, older kids, protecting younger kids when this whole story is told, as well as, of course, they were very close by an excellent children's hospital, Minneapolis Children's, where they got incredible surgery immediately. And I'm sure all of that combined to save so many lives. But we mourn, of course, this little 8 and 10-year-old. Imagine their families dropping them off for the day and then never seeing them again alive.
If I may, I want to get your thoughts on something that the mayor of Minneapolis had to say at a press conference earlier today. Here's Jacob Fry.
Don't just say this is about thoughts and prayers right now. These kids were literally praying. They should be able to go to school or church in peace without the fear or risk of violence, and their parents should have the same kind of assurance.
Senator, we have seen so many debates about gun legislation start and then dissolve so many times on Capitol Hill. And I'm going to ask you a question that I'm not even sure is worth asking anymore. You tell me, what can lawmakers do differently to get change to happen? What does it take for the Senate to meaningfully address gun violence in this country?
You know, nearly every state has experienced some kind of mass shooting. And the thought that people then are scared. When you think about how those kids felt under the pews, and then these politicians are scared to do a number of things that make sense that aren't going to hurt law-abiding gun owners, that aren't going to hurt hunters. I'm in a big hunting state. You could ban assault weapons, and I believe one of these, there was a shotgun, there was a pistol, and then there was a rifle that may or may not have been an assault weapon. But in so many of the other mass shootings, Uvalde, in Buffalo, having met some of those families, those were assault weapons. You could do that. You could put triggers on when the amount of guns someone buys at once, especially if they're
but
under
these solutions
age.
Are not getting passed
I know,
in
but
the U.S. Congress.
I'm just telling you these things would work, and I'm also telling you it's not one or the above, right? Ghost guns, doing something more on the red flag laws. We did pass one bipartisan bill, Senator Murphy and Senator Cornyn, and actually my provision on domestic assault, convicted domestic assault offenders not being able to purchase a gun was a major piece of that legislation. But that was just the surface. And I just, when you talk to these families, as I've talked to the Sandy Hook families and the like, they're so courageous. They've lost their babies, and they come forward and come to Washington and tell their stories. And then politicians are too scared of pissing off one group or one group of voters, when in fact, if they would stand up and explain, this won't hurt hunting. This isn't going to do anything to limit your ability to be in a deer stand like my Uncle Dick does. This isn't going to hurt you. Then we could get this done. And so there is that. There is, of course, the hate. You're going to find that this perpetrator, that this horrific offender, that it was all-purpose hate, right? He hated a lot of different groups. It wasn't one ideology or another.
We're going to have to leave it there. That is Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. Thank you very much
for
taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for thinking of us. Thank you.
The Food and Drug Administration has approved the next round of COVID-19 vaccines, but the agency is imposing new restrictions on who's eligible to get the shots. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is here to explain. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Ari.
What did they announce today?
The FDA approved
updated versions of the Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna, and Novavax COVID shots that have been reformulated to provide the best possible protection against the latest variants. And in the past, the FDA said anyone at least 6 months old could get vaccinated, but the FDA is now saying the shots are only approved for people at risk for serious COVID complications. And that's people who are 65 or older, or younger people who have some other health issue that makes COVID really risky for them, like, you know, a weak immune system, cancer, or heart disease.
That's a big change. What did the government say about why they're making this change?
Yeah, so Trump administration health officials like Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. say, look, most people have so much immunity now that they don't have to keep getting shot after shot after shot. They also question how effective the vaccines are, even though they've been proven to be very safe and have saved millions of lives. And they also say the list of conditions that make people eligible for the vaccines is pretty long and includes lots of very common conditions like asthma, diabetes, obesity, and even just having a sedentary lifestyle.
Well, how are people responding to the new guidance?
So many critics of the COVID vaccines welcome the change, and many public health authorities do agree that many healthy adults and older healthy children probably have enough immunity now that they don't necessarily need to continue getting vaccinated routinely. But many are still outraged by these new rules, and that's because they say younger healthy adults and parents of healthy children should at least have the option of getting themselves or their kids vaccinated if they want to, because, say, they just don't want to get sick, miss school or work, or end up with long COVID, or spread the virus to grandma or some other vulnerable loved one. I talked about this with Dr. Tina Tan. She heads the Infectious Disease Society of America.
I'm worried that this puts the entire American population at risk for severe COVID disease and the complications associated with it. People are not going to be able to get the vaccine if they want it, and you're going to see an increase in the number of individuals that are hospitalized or that potentially could die.
And public health experts like Tan are especially alarmed by the fact that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has also scrapped recommendations that all healthy children and healthy pregnant women routinely get vaccinated, even though COVID can still be really dangerous for them, especially little babies.
Dr. Tan said people are not going to be able to get the vaccine if they want it. Is it that clear cut?
Well, you know, that's kind of a muddle right now, actually, because, you know, many people may still be able to get the shot even if they don't officially qualify, but it won't be nearly as easy. They will probably have to find a doctor willing to prescribe the shots for what's called off-label use and may have to pay for the pricey shots themselves if insurance stops covering them. And no one knows how many doctors will be willing to prescribe the vaccines off-label or how many will still be stocking the vaccines, and also whether pharmacists will be willing or able to administer them. That'll probably vary widely around the country. So there's a lot of concern that we may be going through a kind of flashback to the early days of the pandemic when lots of people had to scramble to get vaccinated and sort through all the confusion about who's eligible for a shot and how to get one.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein, thank you.
You bet, Ari.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 4:18. In a few moments, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. We have a chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, lows in the mid-50s. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, August 27th, in the year 1997, the mountain maple seeds are ripening. Mountain maple is a relative of all the other maples that we are so familiar with, the box elder, the red maple, the sugar maples, all of the maples that you are familiar with, and sometimes the one that gets overlooked is the mountain maple. It's usually a shrub, seldom more than 20 feet high. It has a maple-shaped leaf, and it has a cluster of samaras and seeds that you would expect on a maple. And this time of year, those samara and those seeds become a brilliant coral color, and they're hard to overlook. The leaves of the tree might be starting to turn red, but the seeds are what really grab your eye, those beautiful coral-colored seeds. So watch for the mountain maples and learn to identify them and to appreciate their fall beauty.
Comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa Cook is in the headlines this week because President Trump is trying to fire her. But economists have long recognized her for her research, including work on innovation and economic growth. To get to know her work, we turned to Karen Duffin and Mary Childs of our Planet Money podcast. They looked at Lisa Cook's work back in 2020, before she was nominated to the Fed board. Their story picks up with Lisa Cook's work relating to one of the most impactful ideas in economics called endogenous growth theory. It says that a country can cause more economic growth by fostering innovation through things like investing in science, encouraging market competition, and passing strong patent laws.
Paul Romer eventually won the Nobel Prize in Economics for it, and he taught it to an entire generation of economics students.
But one of those students, a PhD candidate named Lisa Cook, as she learned about this, she thought, I'm not sure it's that simple.
It seemed naive. You can have laws on the books and not enforce them and never have growth.
Lisa Cook was skeptical in part because of personal experiences. For one, she'd spent some time in Russia. She was studying the banking system there in the 1990s. At the time, Russia technically had patent laws.
But no one seemed to enforce them. For example, several of the bankers she was supposed to interview disappeared mysteriously.
If you're afraid for your life, you're probably not inventing things.
Also, Romer's big innovation theory assumes that the law is enforced equally. And Lisa knows very personally, for example, from her childhood in Georgia, equal treatment is not guaranteed.
I was desegregating schools along with my sisters. You know, I was beaten up. I still have scars from that. Hair won't grow in my eyebrow, and a scar on my leg from having been beaten during the period of desegregation.
So Lisa is pretty sure she's found a blind spot in the hot new economic theory. Maybe innovation also requires safety and equality.
To test her hunch, she needs to find a pool of inventors where some were subject to violence and inequality and others weren't. For innovation, there actually is a way to count ideas, patents on inventions. She'll look at data from 1870 to 1940 and compare the number of patents filed by Black and white inventors. If Black inventors file fewer patents during periods of increased violence and lawlessness, and they file more patents when violence and lawlessness decrease, then she's proven it.
The thing that I was deluded about was that all these data were just hanging around and available. Patents were not searchable. There was no Google patents. You know, race is not recorded on the patent record.
Lisa will have to, patent by patent, figure out a way to identify the race of each filer for the 2 million patents filed in that 70-year period.
It took me a year to identify the names and then a year to match them to the data and then another year to fail at that.
So she plots out the number of patents filed per year chronologically on a graph. She can look back in time and see how Black innovation grew or fell in different times and places throughout this history.
Starting at the beginning of her data set in 1870, the Civil War was receding in the background. The 14th Amendment had recently passed.
During this period, African Americans made a lot of gains, holding office, owning property, and filing more and more patents. She sees the line on her graph rise.
They invented all kinds of things in this period. An elevator, rotary engines, a tapered golf tee, a dough kneader, a telephone system, a fertilizer distributor.
But then the story her data set was telling her took a turn.
There was a sharp decline in patenting right at 1900, around the time of Plessy versus Ferguson and thereafter.
Plessy versus Ferguson. The Supreme Court ruling that gave official legal sanction to a so-called separate but equal America. Legislators were passing laws that pushed African Americans into not at all equal homes and schools, or just cut off access to things altogether. But then she sees another big dip in the patent filings from African Americans and realizes that 1921 was the year of one of the worst incidents of racial violence in American history. The Tulsa Race Massacre.
This one neighborhood in Tulsa had become famous as a bustling, affluent community. But in late May of 1921, mobs of white men invaded the town. They massacred residents. They also firebombed the neighborhood from airplanes. This haven of Black affluence burned to the ground.
Tulsa demonstrated that no one would help them. No one. At every single level, nobody had their backs. They were all afraid.
It was a message that was heard across the country.
If I'm a Black inventor in another city, why would I ever invent anything if I thought the intellectual property was never going to be defended?
Patent filings by African Americans dropped off across the country.
The divergence between white patenting and Black patenting was just so stark.
When she does the final math, she finds that the United States had lost out on more than 1,100 inventions from Black inventors.
The number of patents that were lost would be equivalent to that of a medium-sized European country at the time.
An entire Netherlands.
So Lisa has found the gap in the innovation theory that she had suspected might be there. The idea that if we just make strong patent laws, that innovation will come. Her data show it's true for some people, not true for others.
As Lisa's research showed, if you aren't putting all of the variables into these equations that you're using to explain the world, maybe because you haven't learned about those things or lived them or you don't believe they even exist, if you're missing a variable, you'll get the wrong answer.
If there is something that impedes the rate of arrival of ideas, you're going to slow down the economy. It's not just for that period, and it's not just for Black people. This is a cautionary tale for all economies.
Lisa extended her initial data set through 2010 to see how far things had come.
1899 was the peak year for African American patents per capita. It still is. That has not returned.
It took roughly 10 years for Lisa Cook to get her paper published in an economic journal. That full story from Karen Duffin and Mary Childs can be found on the NPR website. Just search for Lisa Cook and Planet Money.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a few moments, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses like smart biz to manage voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net. Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. We also thank the Timberlake Lodge and Hotel in Grand Rapids. On-site amenities include a restaurant with a full bar and the Grand Splash pool area with water slides and a hot tub. Further details at timberlakelodgehotel.com. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, partly to mostly cloudy, lows 53 to 56. Patchy fog early tomorrow, becoming mostly sunny, highs 67 to 75. For Friday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 70s.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The federal government is in the process of rewriting the rules for how it issues federal contracts, which has some Alaska Native organizations concerned. Ayolna Niden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Christopher Slotty is an attorney who works with Alaska Native villages, regional corporations, and tribal governments. He was previously a vice president of the Old Harbor Native Corporation. Slotty says that over the years, more and more Native corporations have turned to federal contracts for revenue, which then gets paid out to shareholders. But he says this could change.
If there is a reduction in federal contracting dollars available to Alaska Native corporations, or they don't have as much success in that arena, they would reduce in size, at least on a revenue basis, which could have an impact on dividends.
The concern is that the federal government is currently rewriting its rules for awarding contracts. That's a result of an executive order President Trump signed in April. It directs the government to remove unnecessary contracting rules that are not required by statute. In 2021, Alaska Native corporations received more than $11 billion from federal contract revenue, according to data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Slotty says that in part, ANC's participation in federal contracts has grown because Congress gave tribes and corporations easier access to the U.S. Small Business Administration programs.
It provides a little bit more level playing field for ANCs to compete for work. They don't have to compete with like Boeing or Northrop Grumman, right? These really massive multinational companies.
One worry Alaska Native contractors have is that the government might remove something called the Rule of Two. It directs government agencies to set aside projects to small businesses if two or more small businesses are able to do them. Slotty says that eliminating the rule could make it difficult for small businesses, including Native contractors, to compete for the work. I am Alyona Niden.
The sci-fi comedy series Resident Alien has ended its fourth and final season, leaving First Nations actor Gary Farmer weighing his next opportunity. Brian Bull, senior reporter for Buffalo's Fire, caught up with Farmer recently in Albuquerque.
Resident Alien not only features the titular extraterrestrial running amok in Colorado, but also several members of the Ute tribe, including Dan 12 Trees. Farmer plays the tribal elder and diner owner, who's the adoptive father to Asta 12 Trees. When not wrestling with alien mayhem, the story often turns to happenings with the Native community. In the sixth episode of the fourth season, Harry the Alien observes his first powwow and is consumed with the music and sense of community.
Now, come on. How do you feel?
I feel like you keep hitting me, but I also feel like I'm connected to everything. It's like Wi-Fi.
Farmer says Resident Alien made Native people a part of the story without relegating them to stereotypes or background dressing. Overall, it was a special experience.
It was a real family. I mean, you have a showrunner like Christopher Sheridan. He's a human being, and you can see it in the show. There's not a lot of human beings out there in my business. They got other interests, mostly financial.
Farmer says there's talk of a possible feature film that'll continue the Resident Alien story. But in the meantime, he's playing gigs on the road with his band, Gary and the Troublemakers. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Albuquerque.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. The Israeli attack that killed five journalists in Gaza also killed four medical staff and a rescue worker at the Nasser Hospital. The unprecedented killing of local journalists and Israel barring almost all foreign journalists from Gaza has left doctors and nurses among the most important witnesses to the war's catastrophic toll on civilians. But now, as Jane Araf reports, Israel is increasingly rejecting foreign doctors applying to volunteer in Gaza, many of them Americans. And a note, this piece contains descriptions of death, violence, and children harmed in war.
Dr. Yasser Arain is a pediatrician from Texas whose specialty is treating the sickest of sick babies, preterm infants, or those with birth defects. He volunteered last year in Gaza. He says it was terrible and traumatic, and he couldn't get it out of his mind. Arain, who's 40, decided to go back. He was accepted by a medical aid organization, had his credentials approved by the UN Health Organization, took leave from his practice, and bought a ticket to Jordan. And then?
So I got that approval. I had been obviously planning for months on end. And on my way to Amman, I get a text message saying that I was denied.
An arm of the Israeli military sent a message to his organization with a red line through his name. A Jordanian doctor due to go in with him was also denied. There was no explanation. Back in the U.S., Arain had been vocal about his experience, including his first patient in Gaza, a 9-day-old baby.
On April 12th, he's breastfeeding with his mother in their tent in Nusayrat refugee camp when a quadcopter came down and started shooting. And a bullet went in through one side of his skull and outside of the other.
Medical aid organizations say the rejections are part of a pattern by Israel. The head of the Palestinian American Medical Association, Dr. Mustafa Muslah, says rejections have increased over the last 3 months.
I would say more than 50% of the doctors that we send end up being denied.
Although the applications are sent to the UN weeks in advance, the unexplained Israeli denials are relayed just hours before the mission starts.
So this doctor takes 4 weeks of time off, and then literally like 4 to 6 hours before the entry, we get the confirmation of approval or denial.
That means that security convoys taking medical staff to Gaza often leave half empty.
Those are specialties that are highly needed, and if those doctors did not get in, those patients will not get treated. You know, it's as simple as that.
He said the day before, an oncologist was among two doctors scheduled to go into Gaza with PAMA, as his organization is known. Both were denied. The increasing rejections are in addition to previous Israeli restrictions, including banning medical volunteers with Palestinian heritage and preventing teams from taking in any medical supplies, according to aid groups. Israel, in response to NPR questions, said only that the entry process is subject to prior security screening. Until May of last year, PAMA used to send in 15 to 20 doctors at a time, with up to 400 suitcases with medication and equipment.
Of course, it was not even enough, but like, you know, it was something, you know, that we at least were facilitating their work when they get in.
With so many Gaza journalists killed and Israel barring almost all foreign reporters, doctors and nurses have been among the last remaining witnesses to what's happening in Gaza. In a hotel room in Amman, Dr. Mimi Sayad, an American emergency room physician, has just been told 2 hours ago that Israel rejected her for her third trip in. Sayad has also been vocal about the medical catastrophe in Gaza, speaking publicly with officials, including the UN Secretary General.
It just seems like, you know, this is a targeting of certain people who are going to be exposing the truth of what's happening in Gaza, another way to prevent that.
She and a French doctor had already landed in Jordan, a requirement for being considered for the missions, before both were told they were rejected. On her previous missions to Gaza, Sayad befriended a sixth-year medical student.
I'm very close with, and I speak to her daily. She's like my sister. And when I had to tell her the news that I was denied, you know, the message she sent me is shattering.
The student did not want to be identified because of fear of retaliation by Israel. The message she sent, the sound of drones in the background, seemed like a goodbye.
I no longer have any hope. Everything feels over. Mimi, I don't want anything from life except death. Because I truly believe I will find peace in it. I wish there another chance to see you, my dear, hug you, but I know I won't make it.
The message left Sayad in tears.
And I can't tell you what that makes me feel like. It's devastating, and I feel hopeless that I can't provide anything for her.
Despite the increased danger, she's desperate to go back. She says it's because she has small children, and she feels like all of Gaza's children are her children. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
In the summer, cities get especially hot. Some of that heat comes directly from the sun, of course, but in urban environments, heat also gets absorbed and then released by the pavement, buildings, and other objects.
When I'm in the streets and I pass by a car, I can feel the heat radiating from it. People often feel this, but they don't ask, why is this happening?
That is Marcia Matias, a PhD student and researcher with the Institute of Geography and Spatial Planning at the University of Lisbon. She can cite many reasons why cities are often significantly warmer than surrounding rural areas. The phenomenon even has a name, the urban heat island.
And we've known about that for a while, but in her team's new study published in the journal City and Environment Interactions, Matias writes that one underestimated factor in urban warming is heat radiating from parked cars, especially the darker ones. Matias and her colleagues measured the air temperature in the area around a black car and a white car on a hot day in Lisbon.
Black car will be increasing on average the air temperature around it by 2 degrees.
2 degrees Celsius, that's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit.
So it's a very big difference between a dark colored car and a light colored car.
That's right. The reason for the temperature difference is that white vehicles reflect between 75 and 85% of incoming sunlight. Meanwhile, black vehicles absorb most incoming sunlight, then radiate it out as heat. And Matias says that if you think about this effect with hundreds of thousands of cars, well, all that heat radiating back into the city adds up.
We are making plans about climate change based on models that don't account for specific elements. Probably we should be also thinking about how cars are influencing our air temperature inside cities.
The study does note that this data was gathered at one specific time, but Matias is confident that vehicle colors do impact air temperature.
In addition to other urban heat mitigation strategies, like more green spaces, more trees, and more shade, Matias says governments could encourage manufacturers to use reflective coatings or get people to simply buy brighter cars.
She says fleets of municipal vehicles, like buses and police cars, would be a good start and could be a small step in making the sweltering summer heat a little more bearable.
You're
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:44. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, news stories from communities throughout Minnesota. We've received support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Grand Rapids River Fest is Saturday, September 6th. We feature Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find tickets and more information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. And you can tune into Headwaters tonight with Kari Headland. She'll be speaking with Alan Sparhawk, that interview, at about 11 o'clock tonight. The Friends of Lake Bemidji State Park have a pancake breakfast this Sunday from 8 to 10 at the park's dining hall. Bring your own plates and utensils to help the environment. Let us know what's happening in your community. Email us, psa@kaxe.org.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota.
A new award program aims to help solve missing and murdered Indigenous relatives' cases. Then, we begin a two-part series looking at how the elimination of federal funding is impacting public and community media in Minnesota. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Department of Public Safety's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office, or MMIR, has launched a reward fund tip program. The new initiative offers rewards of up to $10,000 for tips in missing persons, suspicious deaths, and homicide investigations involving Indigenous relatives. The goal is to bring justice and closure to families affected by the MMIR crisis. 16 cases are currently eligible for rewards. Tips can be submitted directly to law enforcement or through Crime Stoppers. Next, after nearly 60 years, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, is shutting down. Minnesota will lose about $17 million in federal funding for public radio and television. In the first of two special reports, Zan Holston looks at what the cuts mean for community radio stations in Minnesota.
You're listening to KKWE 89.9 FM Niji Radio, White Earth, Minnesota.
At the White Earth Reservation in Callaway County, KKWE Radio has been on the air since 2011. Right now, station manager Maggie Rosso is wondering how much longer they can hang on.
We pulled back in all our spending. We definitely right now have 3 months.
Congress defunded the CPB in July, and nearly half of KKWE's budget, about $200,000, disappeared with it. Hope hasn't.
It seemed really devastating when it first came to us. But as we've talked and we've brought more people into the conversation, it feels like we can be successful in moving forward.
KKWE is one of 17 member stations across Minnesota that are part of AMPERS, the Association of Minnesota Public and Educational Radio Stations. AMPERS stations aren't affiliated with and don't get any funding from Minnesota Public Radio, also known as MPR, or TPT, Twin Cities Public Television.
The loss of federal funding is a very significant concern and could mean the demise of some of our stations.
That's AMPERS CEO Joel Glazer speaking at a recent listening session with U.S. Congresswoman Betty McCollum about the fallout from Congress defunding the CPB. Glazer said the cuts are hitting AMPERS stations especially hard because
we don't have big development teams. We don't have multi-million dollar budgets. But our stations play a very, very important role in their local communities.
Of the 17 AMPERS stations, 10 are losing between 10 to 50% of their annual budgets, about $3 million. That loss is magnified by how small most of the station's budgets and staff are.
These cuts are hitting the native stations and our other stations in greater Minnesota the hardest.
A couple hours east of White Earth, KOJB serves the Leech Lake area.
You're listening to KOJB 90.1 FM, The Eagle.
KOJB is losing about 35% of its budget. Station manager Chris Badeau said it will leave a big gap, but it's one they've been planning for by exploring ways to reduce their dependence on federal money. One of those ideas is launching a satellite station in the Twin Cities to expand KOJB's reach and tap into the state's largest native population.
And that's been in the works for about 6 to 8 months. You know, it's just a planning and timing thing.
Badeau said the expansion could help the station build new connections and revenue streams in a much larger market.
Anything we can do to further our reach and promote our programming in order to maybe have some more support and understand how viable we are to our local communities.
He said that while the loss of CPB funding is a serious blow, they're determined to adapt.
It's unfortunate that this happened, but there's nothing you can do about it. You can do two things, just sit there and worry about it, or go and do something about it and create new partners and new revenue streams.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
It should be noted that Ampers produces North Star Stories and is responsible for its content. Ampers itself does not receive CPB funding, but helps raise funds for its 17 community radio stations. Ampers is conducting a first-ever statewide funding campaign to help replace the loss of federal funding. Information about that fundraiser is online at ampers.org. Tomorrow, we'll look at how the federal cuts are impacting Minnesota Public Radio, Twin Cities Public Television, and the smaller public TV stations, which are not affiliated nor do they share funding with the 17 community radio stations discussed in today's report.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. U.S. high schools are graduating a higher percentage of students than ever before, and educators view the trend as a success. Some students are getting there with the help of credit recovery programs, which let them retake courses they failed the first time. Advocates say it's a way to keep kids from dropping out, but critics say it could be lowering standards. Suzanne Perez of member station KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, has this report.
On a summer evening at Heights High School in Wichita, students in caps and gowns file into the auditorium for one last commencement ceremony.
Congratulations, class of 2025.
It's more than a month after most high schools have finished their graduation events, but the students crossing the stage this evening needed extra time to finish the coursework required for a high school diploma. Jessica Ross ended her senior year lacking several key credits in English, math, and science.
It was pretty tough, but there was days I wanted to give up, but I told myself not to give up.
Jessica enrolled in a district initiative called Within Reach, and within a few weeks, she completed assignments and got the credits she needed to graduate. Others at this delayed commencement made up classes during a three-week summer program.
Well, I wanted to make my mom proud and make my family proud.
Across the country, schools have broadened the ways in which students who fall behind can get back on track for graduation, often without repeating a whole semester or year of school. Credit recovery options range from computer labs in classrooms to after-school programs in office buildings or shopping malls. Wichita Superintendent Kelly Bielefeld says some students would drop out without a viable path to recover credits.
Life happens for our kids. Life happens, and so you might have a semester that doesn't go well for whatever reason, some family issues, some, you know, you're working a lot, whatever. There's all sorts of reasons why. And so to give a student a second chance.
Studies show that more than two-thirds of public high schools offer some type of credit recovery, and the number has likely grown following the COVID pandemic. The incentive for districts is pretty simple. The more students who graduate on time, the higher that school's graduation rate. And graduation rates, like test scores, are a key measure of educational progress.
No one wants kids to not graduate. The trick with credit recovery is helping kids who are already behind to catch up and to do it without watering down expectations.
That's Nat Malkus, Deputy Director of Education Policy at the American Enterprise Institute. He says credit recovery done well can get students back on track without sacrificing standards. What's troubling, he says, is when students complete a semester of work in a matter of weeks or even days.
This is the hardest work in education, catching up students who have already fallen behind and doing it quickly. And we need to treat it as such rather than putting together programs of study or online courses that are shortcuts.
It's hard to know how many students enroll in credit recovery or how effective it is, because policies vary widely by state and school district. UCLA researcher Jordan Rickles says the pandemic increased the demand for programs to help students graduate.
So there's proliferation of need out there for credit recovery and kind of absence of evidence about what works.
In a recent study, Rickles compared computer-based programs with teacher-directed ones and found little difference in student outcomes. He says there's no question credit recovery has helped schools boost their graduation rates. But that's not a bad thing when you consider the alternative.
what would that student's high school experience look like if there was no credit recovery? I don't think it would be better. Just keeping students enrolled in school and making some progress should be considered at least part of a win.
Bielefeld, Wichita's superintendent, says it's vital that schools offer alternate pathways to graduation and not punish students who make mistakes. In the end, he says, the students have to do the work.
We're not giving out diplomas. These kids are working hard to earn diplomas.
The U.S. Department of Education is expected to release new data in coming months that will show how many schools offer credit recovery and how many students are enrolled in it. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Perez in Wichita.
All right, you have probably heard by now, whether you like it or not, because the barrage of news on this will not stop. The pop star Taylor Swift is engaged to Kansas City football star Travis Kelce, and she has got a huge diamond to show for it. Kansas City, by the way, has become headquarters for the Swiftie-Kelce Alliance, and all of that puts more eyeballs on the city, as well as on the team that Kelce plays for, the Kansas City Chiefs. The attention might be unwanted by some NFL fans, but it is great news for someone like Ryan Fortney. He's VP of Sales for Charlie Hustle, a company that sells Kansas City-themed apparel, and he, maybe more than anyone else, knows the excitement this romance is driving. Hello, hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Okay, so I looked through your catalog, and one of your Kansas City Chiefs t-shirts says, "In my ring era." I have to say, I find this very suspicious because you turned this around so quickly. So I have to ask you, did you guys have advance warning of the engagement news?
We didn't, unfortunately. That would have been great to be given a heads up. But, I mean, in Kansas City, we are always prepared for something exciting to happen. You know, whether it's a Super Bowl win or a World Series, there always seems to be something.
Between Super Bowl wins and Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce getting engaged, which is bigger news?
Probably Travis and Taylor.
Oh, yeah. Kansas City Chiefs fans are hissing. Or maybe not.
As a lifelong Chiefs fan, you knew there was going to be an era like this eventually, but I don't think anyone could have predicted what's been going on between these two.
You all have been in business for, what, almost 14 years? Like, mm-hmm. Well before the Swift-Kelce love story even began. Has there been a noticeable Taylor Swift bump in sales the last couple years?
100% there has been. I mean, there's been a noticeable bump in Chiefs fans thanks to Taylor Swift. So everybody is like wanting to get their hands on products that celebrate the Chiefs and celebrate everything that's going on. So, I mean, you can't throw a stone in this city without hitting something that has to do with the Chiefs or with Taylor.
So what have been popular products that have sold a lot, like disproportionately more in the last couple of years because of the romance?
We have definitely introduced some more feminine products for Chiefs fans.
We're not talking about in a drugstore, people.
Yes, for lack of a better word, for sure. You know, she has that very girly aesthetic to her that she really owns and she's so proud of. And, you know, we've really introduced a lot of that stuff as well to make sure that, you know, her fans have the product that they need to celebrate her and the Chiefs.
Okay, and we are, again, only in the engagement period. I'm just wondering, what is your wedding merch going to look like? Is that going to be next level?
I just need to know what the date is first. As soon as they announce a date, then we'll have a better idea of what we can look to celebrate it.
That is Ryan Fortney, VP of Sales for Charlie Hustle in Kansas City. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Visit St. Pete, Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. nprwineclub.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and at 7 tonight, Sarah.